Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Chris from the Fairmount Clubhouse in Philadelphia.
Okay, all right. I'm being recorded, so that's new. My name is Chris, I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous has never failed me. I'm extremely, extremely grateful for the life that I've been afforded through working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the way my journey has unfolded has been nothing. You know, I remember in the beginning, I had a lot of expectations out of what I could get out of the steps. Of course, you know, like I wanted to, you know, do nothing and get everything. That was my MO. And so I quickly got into that. And of course, I was wanting to drink, and I was calling my lawyer every other day, trying to get him to file a motion, get me out of this halfway house and all this other stuff. And then I surrendered. And for the first time in my life, I knew that as long as I didn't drink, everything was going to be okay. And for the first time in my life, deep down, a wave of peace hit me that I'd never felt before. And without a single chemical in my body, I was okay with just being okay. I'd never been able to reach that point before. And it happened in a candlelight meeting, bringing in the New Year's. I sobbed. And I threw snot everywhere, and it was a very profound experience for me, and it was the beginning of educational variety spiritual experience. I didn't say that day, now I'm going to do my worksheets in rehab. I didn't say that day, now I'm actually going to participate in the big book studies, and you know, I definitely didn't say that day that I'm going to stay sober. For going on 9 years, starting right now, you know. But it happened. So I'm gonna go unconventional here, and I'm gonna tell you a little bit about my sobriety today, and just relate little pieces back of how I got here. And today I'm living in Philadelphia, and I didn't plan on going to Philadelphia. But I ended up there, and I'll get to how I got there later. And I ended up getting a home group at the Fairmount Clubhouse, right above the Art Museum. There's a nice little neighborhood that I somehow ended up in, and somehow I got paid my bills, and you know, I'm able to stay in a pretty nice apartment. You know, that's crazy. And I was able to get a sponsor. I was able to plug in, and wherever I go, Alcoholics Anonymous never fails me. And I remember in the beginning, my first sponsor, he gave me lots of spiritual gems along the way that I've been able to really utilize over the years. And one of those was that Bill W. talked a lot about two principles, really summing up the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and those two principles being love and service. And just the way AA has never failed me, love and service has never failed me either in sobriety. So I was able to get a job, and that job was with a nonprofit organization, and it's very much in service on a daily basis, working with young people ages 18 and 26, referred to us from different youth violence prevention organizations. We enrolled them in 6 months of AmeriCorps service, and then we partnered with the City Water Department and Parks and Rec to do environmental projects throughout the city. I do social work with them. I have a caseload of around 30, and we work through all sorts of barriers, including substance abuse, and also just loving ourselves in the process. And it has been a great place to experience some healing. And in large part, that was due to Alcoholics Anonymous sweeping me up in fellowship and loving me when I found it hard to love myself. So, rewind, I'm from Alabama, in case you hear that when I talk, everybody else seems to. So, I grew up in Alabama, and I grew up in a home that I didn't want for anything, but I definitely wanted for attention, and I wanted for validation, and I wanted for love, because I didn't feel like I was getting it. My father was very physically abusive to me and my brother, from around 3 years old to around 14 or 15, when I got big enough to, you know, start fighting back and that sort of thing. And so that led me to a point, you know, where I was around 10, and we were building a house. And while building this house, the roofers had just gotten done the day before. And me and my brother, it was our job to go around and clear up all the scrap wood around and throw it in the fire pit that we had dug out. And because the roofers had just got done, there was a CO2 cartridge from a nail gun that was in the wood that I was cleaning up. And so I ended up throwing that CO2 cartridge into the fire. It exploded, came out, hit me in the mouth, and knocked out all my teeth. And split my lip down to my gum. And so from 10 to 16, I didn't have any front teeth. I also liked to eat a lot of Fruity Pebbles back then, so I was a little bit heavier set. And so school was not fun. School was not fun. I went there and I was full of fear because I was getting made fun of a lot for those two things. And then I came home and I was also full of fear. So I didn't know what kind of day my dad had had, and when he got home, what was going to happen. And so around 10, 11, 12, you know, I don't have coping skills. I don't know what those are, really. And I feel trapped. And so the first time that I was able to get a hold of some alcohol, that was going to be a great solution. And it was. And it just happened to be Wildcat Moonshine. And so It wasn't even a full pint, it was a half pint. And I got it from my brother's older friends, and I think I paid like $50 for a half pint, you know, or something. I like saved up all my money, and I was like, here you go, you know, just take it. And then, of course, you know, they knew that it was my first time, and they dared me to chug it. And so I was like, yeah, moonshine, I'll chug it. And so I did that, and from about chug time to 45 minutes, it was great. I felt really good, and then I blacked out. So that was my first drunk was a blackout and chugging moonshine. Great. Like 2 weeks later, I tried some other outside issues for the first time, and I knew. I was like, this is it. My Willy Wonka golden ticket. This is how I get to the chocolate factory on a regular basis, and this is how I'm not afraid. This is how I'm accepted, and this is my way to be okay with just being okay, even amongst the shit. You know, sorry for the frank language, but it happens. So, I progressed more and more, and before I knew it, you know, I was selling some outside issues, and I was taking a lot of stuff, and I get arrested for the first time when I'm 13. My relationship, which was really, really healthy with the legal system and the judiciary system, lasted for around 9 years, and I was, it was great, guys. Let me tell you, probation is fantastic, and fines, and jails and institutions and death are great, but that's what I started to frequent. Around 15, I failed a drug test, and they were like, "You're going to go to a 3 month long boot camp / rehab." And I said, "Okay," because I didn't have any choice. And the night before, I thought it was going to be great to go out with a bang, you know, because I'm not going to be able to use anything for a while. So I ended up, you know, taking some LSD and some other pills. And then the last thing I remember is walking out. I had a fake ID at the time, too, and they sold a 15-year-old alcohol. I don't know why. And so the last thing I remember is walking out of the liquor store after ingesting all this stuff with two handles of whiskey. And then, flash forward, I'm coming to upside down in a ditch. It's January, it's 3 in the morning. The roof is caved in over my head, and the seatbelt is wrapped around my neck. And I'm inhaling watery, icy mud. And my friend Justin and his girlfriend were on the road screaming. All I could hear was screams, and that was happening. And all of a sudden, I see his arm reach through, and he pulls me out. And for some reason, I thought it was a great idea. I had to get rid of the evidence, not let alone I just crashed my car and I'm leaving it there in the ditch for everybody and God to see. I have to get rid of these clothes, because if I'm really muddy in all these clothes, they're going to know that I'm really messed up. So I just stripped out of all these muddy, bloody clothes. And it's 3 in the morning, and they drop me off in my driveway, and I run up to the door at 3 in the morning, and I ring the doorbell because I don't have my wallet or my keys or anything, because I got rid of my clothes on the side of the road. And I ring the doorbell, and my mom comes to the door, and I'll never forget the look of terror on her face when she saw me, messed up out of my mind. She said I could barely talk. I was that messed up, and I had blood and mud everywhere. I was clearly out of my mind, and so I don't remember anything after that. The next thing I know, I'm coming to in the that boot camp rehab parking lot, and I've got to sign paperwork to get admitted. So turns out my brother had to give me a shower as well before that happened. So thanks, bro. All right, and so I did the whole 3 month thing, and I'm still the same old me. I remember for the first time I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a speaker who came in. It was this woman. She was talking about a solution. She was talking about how her life got better when she did this stuff on the wall, and how she had the spiritual awakening, and all this stuff. And I was like, that sounds great, but I'm just not with it right now. I've got a lot of really important stuff to do. I got to add stuff to my resume for my drinking and drugging career. There's a lot of really important things out there. So I wasn't buying what she was selling. And the week before I got out, my mom came for one last visit, and she said that her and my dad are getting a divorce. Her and my brother had already moved out into an apartment. And so there goes the family that I thought I was going back to, and there I go with those ill coping skills again. And so I get out, and I'm just plastered the first night. My good old buddy Jeremy, he knew, like, when I get out of rehab for 3 months, I'm going to need an ice-cold bottle of whiskey. And he had it in the center console, so thank you, Jeremy. Rinse, repeat. That happens for the next couple years, and I end up going to some more rehab, some inpatient stays. I go to outpatient, I'm just not ready, I mean, bottom line, I want to get drunk more than I want to get sober. I want to change the way I feel, because I feel like crap on the inside. I'm suffering from a spiritual malady that I don't know that I suffer from. I have a spiritual accident that doesn't allow me to be okay with myself, my surroundings, and there's this itching, scratching, burning notion that this time's going to be different. And I followed that, and I chased that, and I obsessed about that. And I didn't know what what was around the corner, and I didn't know what I was developing. And what I was developing was a thing called alcoholism. And so I went to all these different treatments, and started psychiatry and therapy and stuff, and started taking these different antidepressants, and none of it worked, surprise. And so I got down to the point where I was faced with a couple different decisions. By this point, I was attempting suicide, and one of those attempts landed me in the behavioral unit of a hospital for 4 days. Apparently, after I'd overdosed, I had tried to, hurt the doctors and nurses, and so they put me in the bin with really crazy people. Like, they were actually crazy. I wasn't crazy. I remember coming to in an assless gown on a bed with no sheets or anything, and there was nothing on the walls. And it, I mean, they were tiles. It wasn't padded. They were tiles, and they wouldn't tell me why I was there. And then I remember day three or four. I'm starting to become like them, you know, and. Come to find out, there was a guy. His name was Andy, and he was doing he was running some of the outpatient that I'd been in, you know, years prior. And we're doing seated calisthenics, right? So we're in the chair and we're doing this stuff, you know, and like stretches, and I'm just hating it. And all of a sudden, I see Andy coming down the sidewalk. There's a halo around him, and like doves are released behind him. Because I knew he was coming there for me, and he was. And he said, "We got a bed for you at a rehab." And I was like, "Yes, thank you." I was really, really excited to go to rehab that time. And so I did that 21-day inpatient, and then I went to my first halfway house. And that was the first time that I actually started going to meetings, the first time that I actually got a sponsor and started working the steps. Although... That itching, burning notion that I could control and enjoy my drinking was still burning inside. And I didn't end up staying sober. I ended up lying on my four steps to my sponsor to make myself look cooler, because you should do that. And I got drunk after about 6 months there, and was working on a construction site, and we thought it was a great idea to take our radios and equipment with us while we go to get drunk on Thunderbird. And... you know, we end up getting fired the next day, and then it all crumbles from there. So there was, once I came back from that, I knew that there were some repercussions, and so I ended up coming back, and the very thing that I overdosed on, I said I was never going to take again. And once I came back and relapsed this time, I started taking more of that than I ever have in my life, and I don't really remember the next 2 months after that relapse. And but the judge does, because I got another DUI while I was awaiting a hearing for a felony possession charge. And so naturally, when I go in front of him, he's not happy. And it's basically, you know, you're going to go on to work release. And if you mess up again, like, you're getting locked up for at least a year and a half. And at that point, you know, this was the cycle. This was the rinse repeat cycle that has always been going on. And I didn't see it getting any different. But I do remember... going back to my friend's house, and this was December 18th, 2008. They said, "You got 2 hours to go pack your bags from court and report down to work release." And I went, and I packed my bags, and then I went to my friend's house, and, you know, I had to smoke that last J. And I was telling him, I was like, "You know, guys, I think they hit the nail on the head. You know, I'm powerless. That's what it is. I'm powerless." And, you know, and I'm just, you know, taking hits, so I'm just powerless, man, you know. And, you know, thinking I knew what was going on. And so I end up going to work release, and I wake up the next morning, and they call my name over the intercom, and I'm like, "Dude, I haven't been here maybe 11 hours. There's no way I can already be in trouble." But my mom was there, and she had talked to my probation officer. Probation officer talked to the judge, and they had another rehab for me. So there we go. I was afforded another chance. And I went into that rehab, and for the first 2 weeks, like I said, I was still running game and still, you know, flipping turns and trying to con and manipulate my way out of everything and not taking ownership of the life that I had made for myself and the position I put myself in. And so then I had that spiritual experience in that candlelight meeting. And I remember a couple of days after that, calling my lawyer, telling him not to file those motions that I had previously told him to, and to just let the courts do with me what they will. And things changed after that. They sent me to another halfway house, and I remember it was suggested that for a sponsor, you need to select someone who has something that you want, right? And the very first meeting, I think it was day two there, we went to this meeting and there was this guy, his name was Danny B. And he was actually working at the halfway house. He was a shift manager at Wendy's. He was 58 years old and he was free. First time that I'd ever seen anybody with a light like that in their eyes and the way he interacted with people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, he was free. And I wanted that. I wanted to know how he got that. And he became my sponsor. And like I said, he gave me a lot of spiritual gems that I've been able to use and pass on to other guys I've been fortunate enough to work with over the years. And so I remember when I asked him to be my sponsor, he never cut me slack just because I was, you know, like he worked at the halfway house and I was in the halfway house. He never cut me slack just because I was a sponsee and because I was actually kind of doing the deal a little bit and following suggestions. And before he even agreed to be my sponsor, he said, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" And for the first time in my life, I actually looked him in the eye and said something honest. And I said, "Yeah." And deep down, I meant it. And, you know, if he would have told me to shovel horse crap two times a day and then, like, meditate on that, I probably would have done it. And my ass was on fire, you know. Like, I knew that the only options I had out there were prison and death, you know. Like, that was it. There was no more running game. There was no more cutting corners. The locks had been changed at my parents' house. I wasn't allowed there anymore. They weren't going to support me financially. And, like, my friends were done with me, you know. They were tired of me, like, pissing in weird places in their house and, like, you know, eating their food barehanded out of the fridge at night and, you know, like, waking up to some debacle that I had, like, orchestrated, you know. They were done. And so I said yes, and I remember getting down to steps two and three, and I'd always had these ideas that if there were any type of higher power, it wouldn't allow me to have lived the life that I had and experienced the circumstances and the experiences that I have in my life. But because my ass was on fire, I had surrendered and I was ready to accept anything from anybody outside of myself. Something happened and I was open enough to realize that I don't have to buy into anybody else's conception. But I just have to believe there's a power greater than myself, and it's just not me. There's a higher power out there, and it's just not me. And so I remember getting down the front porch. It was a really sunny day, and we said the third step prayer together. And I was, you know, words didn't mean anything too much to me because I just didn't really identify with, you know, thou art thee and those things. And We moved on to the fourth step, and this time I didn't lie, because I didn't care how I looked to my sponsor. I had to get rid of it. And I remember right before you came to pick me up, I read through it, and I literally laughed out loud. I literally LOL'd, and that was because how brutally honest I was to myself, and I surprised myself. And so I went and I did the fifth step. I didn't have a spiritual awakening directly after that because I went to Applebee's, you know. But but we identified some things. And some things that we identified were character defects. And we took those into steps 6 and 7. Not only did we identify character defects, but we also identified that I had character assets. I've never been told that before, that there were positive things about me. That I wasn't just a really bad human being, but I was sick. And I suffered a spiritual malady due to alcoholism. And whenever the name of the game is 90 to nothing, change the way I feel with a chemical, every day, you're going to do bad things to make that happen. You're going to do things that aren't of you. And you're going to hurt yourself and others around you. So I came to realize that slowly. And I didn't realize the significance of steps 6 and 7. Until much, much farther down the road. But I went into my amends, and they were pretty run-of-the-mill. There weren't too many big ones. There were some financial ones, some past employers that I wrote letters to, and, you know, of course they said, you know, don't worry about, you know, paying us back or anything. Just keep doing what you're doing. My parents gave me the same thing. It was just, like, a pretty easy way out, and that was made up later down the road when I had to make amends sober, you know, because making amends sober sucks. It really does. And so there was this one guy that I owed a lot of money to, and I was probably a year or two sober, and I was out with some friends, and we were in one of those, you know, honky talks, and I turn around, and this guy that I owe money to is right in my face, and he doesn't say, "Hey, how you doing? Glad to see you." He's just like, "You owe me money, you know?" And I said, "Yeah, I sure do." And I pulled out all the money I had in my pocket. It was 20, 30 bucks. And I said, "This is what I got." He looked at it. He looked at me and he said, "That'll do." Grabbed the money out of my hand and just turned around and went and got drinks. So that was, you know, like, it was just really, it was a strange, strange thing to happen for amends. But it happened. So there's that cool story, bro. So I remember when I got down to steps 10, 11, and 12, I didn't really know, like, what the maintenance part of it was, you know, because I hadn't really wrapped my mind around this thing that, you know, if I fail to enlarge my spiritual life, it's just bad news. And so I was still on cloud nine and in this pink cloud, and I was still just like reaping the benefits of like having a cell phone and paying the bill for it and like working a job and having it for over a year and all these new things. And so I didn't really do an inventory at night, and I you know, got along and floated around meetings for a while. And then prayer and meditation, I was like, what do you do? Do you pray and meditate? Like, do you meditate first or do you pray first? Like, would you read stuff or do you do an om? Or, you know, how do you do this? Do you light candles, incense, Reiki stones? I don't know. And so it was put to me very simply that this is how I contact my higher power, and this is how I center myself for the day, and also how I stay in the facts at night. And so the step 10 inventory that I ended up employing later on down the road was starting out with, it was a good sandwich, good hamburger technique. The two buns were gratitude. The first one was five things I'm grateful for. And then I would go down to the fear, the selfishness, dishonesty, and resentment, where I experienced those throughout the day. And then I would cap it off with the best thing that happened that day. And that ended up becoming my 10-step inventory at night, and also included into my prayer and meditation at night as well. And that was beneficial. It helps me stay in the facts that not everything's bad, and that I'm not bad, and like good things actually do happen to me on a daily basis. So that was really helpful. My sponsor introduced me to that. And then I found out that there's no better way for me to enlarge my spiritual life than being of service. And so I was able to connect the dots for 10, 11, and 12, and carrying the message to other alcoholics. I started to get involved on a group level and then an area level and a district level. And I started to see that what makes the coffee flow, the lights turn on, and the doors open for the newcomer, is self-sacrifice and service. Of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, I never really known like what all that was about. But then I got into it, and I started attending business meetings, and you know, we would argue about things like, you know, what brands of sugar to buy, and other really important items. But then they would also send me to area, and I got to connect with alcoholics from all over the great state of Alabama. And I got to be on different committees, and just it was amazing to learn about what alcoholics had done and to learn about the journey that it's had since its conception. And since the Big Book was written in 1939, just like it's all over the world now, you know, the World Service Office. And, you know, later on down the road, I was living in Armenia, and another alcoholic became the points of contact for the country of Armenia for the World Service Office, which was really cool. And we actually got emailed from people who were like coming to Armenia, and they were like, where's the meetings? And we're like, there are none. And it's just us. So like, meet with us in a dingy basement. But there was this whole connection of service, of Alcoholics Anonymous that plugged me in to what I have now formed my life around. And those two principles that my sponsor really reiterated to me in the beginning, I've been able to employ as my centralized path, and those are love and service. And so I got back into school, and I ended up graduating with a degree in social work. And I knew that there had been people, even my probation officers and other like counselors and stuff like that, that helped me to get to where I was at. And I wanted to do that. You know, I wanted to be a part of, I wanted to have a connection, and I wanted to see where this life of service could take me. And man, it's taken me a lot of places, including this fine room with you fine people. So I got my degree in social work, and before I left up out of there, I went to some parties, and in college, it was kind of weird being the young, sober, I was 19 when I got sober. So I was the sober guy at the parties who drove people, and I wouldn't suggest it necessarily, but I also didn't get sober to hide from the world. You know, the world drinks, and there's nothing wrong with that. The only thing wrong with it is when I do it. And I just didn't get sober to hide. And so in the big book, it talks about we can go to what they term as whoopee parties, good old-fashioned whoopee parties, if we have a place there, if we have a purpose. And my purpose was to be a part of with my friends and hopefully just be a part of a good time with them. And it was because the obsession was removed, you know. There's only been two times over the last 8+ years that the obsession has really come back in a very real way. One, I was around 3 months sober at that halfway house, and don't know what it was, but they used to take us to and from work in this 15-passenger van, and they dropped me off, and I was working at Jack's. I don't know if anybody knows about Jack's. Anybody know about Jack's?
Down south.
Yeah, it's down south. It's only down south. So you got to go to make a fine hamburger. They dropped me off in this parking lot, and as soon as I step out of the van, it just hits me like 90 to nothing, and I want to drink. Like, I really, really want to drink. It floods in, and I'm pacing around that parking lot just smoking cigarettes. I got like 20 minutes before I go in. I know there's a liquor store over there. You know, I could just like call them and say, you know, hey, I got sick or something, but I'll be in soon or whatever. And then comes in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it always comes in a really unfortunate way. call another alcoholic. And so I did. I called one of the halfway house managers and just told him that I wanted to drink. And we talked for about 30, 45 minutes. And then about 30, 45 minutes after that, I didn't want to drink. Fast forward a couple years later, I'm about 3.5 years in to the deal. And January, my girlfriend breaks up with me. February, my stepdad died. And then March, my mom was dying. And she had a gastrointestinal infection that was not allowing her to eat. And so she got down to about 105 pounds. She's 5'10", so that was really small for her. She had to get a nutritional port put in and bag nutrition. She had to stop working. She couldn't drive. And it was hard for her to cook for herself before she got the nutritional port. And so anyway, those series of events, January, March, and April, I was very confused, very resentful, and really just wondering why I'd gotten sober for all this to happen. And come a day in April, you know, I woke up and I said, I'm going to drink today. And I was dead set on it. I went into work. I was working in a restaurant, and they're asking what was wrong, and I'm not acting like myself, and I told them, I was like, I'm going to drink, and of course, they tell me not to, and then I was like, yeah, well, I'm going to drink, and so I leave work, and I know I have it planned, where I'm going to get the alcohol, what I'm going to buy, and where I'm going to drink it, And then here it comes again, unfortunate Alcoholics Anonymous, and said, call another alcoholic, talk to another alcoholic. And so I called my sponsor at the time, Charles, and we talked for about 30, 45 minutes, and then we got off the phone, and before I leave, I don't know, I got to go in my room for something, but as soon as I walked the doorway, I collapsed on the floor and had another surrender. And I sobbed for about 15 minutes or so, and it was a breakdown, but it was also a breakthrough. And then I prayed for about 10 or 15 minutes, and right after that, miraculous things started to happen. People in Alcoholics Anonymous that I hadn't been really connected to before started to come into my life in a very meaningful, in-depth, and powerful way. And I started to grow into the fellowship even stronger. And then I did something else that changed my life after that. And that was while I was in college. All this happened while I was in college. And this friend of mine who I worked with was talking about this opportunity to go to Costa Rica to work in a Nicaraguan refugee community for 8 days. And I didn't really know what it was about, but I signed up for it. And I busted my tail at Red Lobster for it to pay. And I ended up going, and it flipped me on top of my head. And so I had these preconceived notions of what a job in social work could be, in an office somewhere, working DHS, or, you know, having a caseload, being a case manager, or, you know, the typical type of social work that you might think of. And all that was erased because I found something that was, it lit my soul on fire. And I found a connection to cultures and communities in a completely different light. And for the first time, I realized that it really wasn't about me. And so I came away from that experience knowing that I had to get more of that. And so I became the head site leader for that organization, and I started leading those trips. And then we started going to trips all over, service projects all over the U.S. as well. And one of those was in Philadelphia. So 2 years later, I came to Philadelphia, and we worked with this collaborative called Philly Rising. It was the police department and different community leaders and community ambassadors, and we worked to clean up the vacant lots and you know, get gardens going and all that sort of stuff. And I had a wonderful time in Philadelphia. And so once I graduated, I was wondering what life was going to be about. And so I called the organization. They were called Appleseed Expeditions, that like guided us in Costa Rica. And Alexander Fuentes was our guide, and he was an amazing human being. He worked for Appleseed. And so I called them up. I was like, hey, I want a job. And they were like, hey, we're hiring. And I was like, hey, here's my resume. And so I ended up getting hired, you know, and I totally didn't expect it to happen. I was just like, hey, just like, I literally just called their office and I said, I want a job with you. And it happened. And so I started leading trips with Appleseed and leading service projects. And they're service learning projects. Does anybody know what service learning is? Great. That's great. No hands. All right. So the difference between service learning and volunteering is one word, and it's education. But what this allows me to do is to take what keeps me sober, service, and employ that to other people. Not only do I get to experience it, but also get to connect to others while we are being of service to communities outside of ourselves. And so we're able to go out and see the communities abroad and the needs that they have, but then also bring it back home and address the needs in our own communities directly around us. Wrap the whole picture on the personal level, the local level, the state level, then the whole United States, and then the global, this whole thing. I'm not going to go into that. But I found what I've been looking for. I was there's this really weird meeting in at the clubhouse in Fairmount in Philadelphia, and it's a interview meeting, right? And so the chairperson calls individuals up just randomly. You don't know if you're going to get called on, so they'll call you up there, and then they'll just ask you questions in front of everybody because it's really great to be uncomfortable in sobriety. And one of the questions he asked was, what have you gotten back since you got sober? And immediately it hit me like a ton of bricks. I said nothing. Because I'd never had any of this before. I'd never had a lick of this before. And the things that I've been given back, you know, I didn't know what spirituality was. I didn't know what a spiritual experience was. But what a spiritual experience is to me is gaining self-esteem through performing esteemable acts. Gaining self-respect through giving respect to other people. And gaining that deep connection and acceptance that I've always craved through simply giving myself in service. And that gives me a why to wake up in the morning. That gives me a depth that I've never had to my life. And it makes me an asset to those around me. I remember once my parents got a divorce, my dad hit a really rough spot, had a rough go of it, and through a lot of work on his part and also a lot of forgiveness on mine. Over the past 8-9 years, since I got sober, we literally haven't even raised our voices to each other once. And we have a pretty loving and connected relationship today. I talk to him on a regular basis and go visit him regularly as well. He lives in Ohio. But I was able to help him through a lot of his periods of, depression and, losing jobs here and there. And had a rough go of it for a while. And, my mom, she had breast cancer when I was drinking. And I remember I got her to buy me 2 bottles of alcohol because I couldn't take her having breast cancer, I remember I would take her to her appointments in Birmingham, Alabama, which is about 2 hours away, and I would be out in the parking lot snorting the pills that I stole from her. And when she came out and they wheeled her out and I had to help her to the car and then drive her home, I was nodding out the whole time. And I could barely help her because I was so messed up. And so then fast forward, when she had that bacterial overgrowth in her lower intestine, I was able to cook for her. I was able to take her to her appointments, be there with her in mind, body, and spirit, and completely be there and be present. And those are priceless gifts. Another part of my spiritual experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is simply being a part of my family's life as I have never been before. My grandfather died when I was about 2 years sober, and I went and saw him 2 weeks before he passed. I spent the week with him. He knew my journey. He'd known everything that I'd been through, and we got to spend really good quality time together before he left us. And those things are completely invaluable and priceless. And I would never, ever be able to be a part of in such a way had I not been given the gift of this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember I met Jeff at this speaker thing in New Jersey 2 months ago, and he told me about the speaker meeting. And I was like, that's cool, man. That sounds like a really cool thing. And he was like, you want to speak? And I don't turn that down, even though I've been working all day and I've got 2 jobs. Another one is coaching CrossFit, and I went and did that and then came here, and it's been a hectic day. I don't turn down service opportunities for Alcoholics Anonymous because I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for giving me a life, for my life. I mean, period. I would not probably be alive nor be in the position that I'm in, anywhere in the area code of the position that I'm in, had it not been for AA. And so when I say that Alcoholics Anonymous has never failed me, I absolutely through and through mean that. I've never seen it fail anyone who gives themselves to the program. It talks about honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And only until I was completely broke down, had no other option, was I able to have any of those, the indispensables of the program. And I've been able to work with some guys over the years and see their lives enriched by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and see them gain self-esteem, gain self-respect, and gain love for themselves and start to actually have interests, have hobbies, passions, things they like and don't like, and find out who the hell they are. And it's been such a ride. So I'll talk about Peace Corps really quick and then I'll shut up. But around 6 years sober, I decided that I wanted to go into the Peace Corps and on the notions of love and service yet again. And so I ended up going to the country of Armenia, which is in Eastern Europe. It borders Turkey, Azerbaijan, Iran, and Georgia. And I went there to do community and youth development. And I knew there was no Alcoholics Anonymous over there. It culturally doesn't make sense. And so mental health, if you want to imagine 1930s and 40s mental health approach, that's the way it is over there today. And so there are no sanatoriums, there are no mental health agencies or behavioral community behavioral health or anything like that. Even in the hospitals, it just doesn't exist. And so I went over there knowing there was no Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, but through giving myself of love and service, I could suffice. I had my literature, I had my sponsor that I could talk to here and there, and I had my prayer and meditation, and I had the fundamentals of the program. And the first 6 months were great, and then around months 8 and 9, I started to really notice some mental health red flags, and around a year, I was more deeply depressed than I'd ever been, and I was lower than I'd been since I was drinking, and I wanted a meeting worse than I wanted a drink back when I was drinking, and I really came to know the distinction between the program and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, what they are apart, but how well they're elevated when they're together. And, I came back to the United States. I ended my service a year early. I made that call. I didn't want to drink, but I know that I don't do well with being uncomfortable for a long amount of time. And I came back here, and I was spiritually decapitated for a good 6, 8, 9 months. And I got back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back to Alabama for a month, and then I moved right to Philadelphia. I didn't know anybody in AA, but there was a clubhouse that was a 7-minute walk from my apartment. And that clubhouse ended up becoming my home group. I met my sponsor 2 weeks into that. And fast forward to Thanksgiving of last year, and I don't have any family up here or anything, so there's this this huge Thanksgiving Day type thing on 4th and Pine at this community center, and I was physically right in the middle of over 100 alcoholics that day, and I started like kind of sobbing again a little bit, but in pure gratitude of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet again, it was reiterated that AA and love and service never fail. And, I then went to my sponsor's family's home for Thanksgiving dinner, and I made a mess of myself, and, it was disgusting. But the fellowship and AA has allowed me to experience some healing, and I'm not spiritually decapitated today. I don't want to drink today. I don't want to kill myself today. I've been afforded all this. But I keep coming back, put my ass in a chair, remain willing, and take suggestions. Suggestions are on the wall. I don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's right up there. It's in the big book. I've got a whole design for living today that allows me to live a life beyond my wildest dreams. If I would have made a list of things I wanted when I first got sober out of sobriety, I would have sold myself way short. I had no idea. But stuff like this is the meat and potatoes, the highlight reel of sobriety. So thank you guys for having me, and thank you for my life.